You're listening to the Mid-Michigan Pet Expert Talk Show, only on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
We're back here with the Mid-Michigan Pet Expert Talk Show. And Rick, we have with us as our guest on the line, Bill Thompson, the editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Well, thanks very much, Lee.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you. Bill, I was reading a fascinating story on your website about your family and how the magazine came about. Can you briefly explain to our listeners exactly the evolution that your family went through in starting Birdwatchers Digest and how you've gotten to where you are?
Well, we started the magazine because my mom developed an interest in birds when she joined a bird club in Marietta, Ohio. We had moved there in the early 70s, and she started going out with a group of women who went out on weekly bird trips. And my brother Andy and I would go along occasionally. We all kind of got into birds. And about that time, my dad was sort of hitting that midlife, questioning his, you know, career sort of point. And he decided he wanted to become his own business. You know, he wanted to start his own business, and we considered a bunch of options. He had a background in journalism, so we decided to start a magazine and looked around and realized there really wasn't a magazine for birdwatchers, so that's what we decided to do. And we pooled all our money, our college money, mom and dad's retirement, everything, and put it into starting the magazine. So I know this sounds familiar to Rick.
Yeah, it really does. I can remember we were like just getting off welfare at the time and hadn't a vehicle, and we had to somehow figure out how to get from the pet store to the coal-burning furnace in our house in order to keep things running so that the pipes didn't freeze.
It was oh, yeah.
Well, not everyone knows the glory of owning your own business, but it is quite a story. And, Bill, since then, the magazine has taken off very well, and I understand a couple of books have been published. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we've always prided ourselves on being really good a really good source of content. You know, we're a magazine for people who read. You know, our size is digest size, sort of Reader's Digest size. So we're not a big coffee table magazine with just pretty pictures. So, you know, from the beginning, we were a magazine for people who like to read, and we still have carried that on. And because we've published so much good content over the years, we've been able to, we've been lucky enough to develop a couple books with some other publishers out there. So I've, you know, written a bunch of books on bird feeding and various things like that, bird identification, and a series of state bird books as well, including one for Michigan.
Well, that one is the one I'm the most familiar with, because if there's a book in my household that is probably the single most used book, it's probably that one, because my wife almost every day is noting the different visitors that come to the different feeders and bird baths that she has going and is constantly looking and trying to identify them. And I think that's probably what got your mom started and really developed the whole enterprise prize that you find yourself involved with.
Yeah, that's true. You know, really, most people do notice birds in their backyard, first of all. And, you know, when someone notices that first bird and it kind of sparks their imagination and sparks their interest, we call that their spark bird. So my spark bird I saw when I was about 6 or 7 years old in our front yard. We were living in Iowa at the time, and a snowy owl came into our yard on Thanksgiving weekend. We were all out raking leaves, and that was the bird that really fired me up. I thought, oh my gosh, there's this giant white owl sitting in our tree, and I had to know what it was. We had a little bird guide at the time and some really awful binoculars, and we managed to identify the bird. And I took that book and went around and tried to identify all kinds of other things. So, you know, that's one of the real goals that we have at Birdwatchers Digest, is we try to fire the imagination of other people for, you know, how wonderful and amazing birds are.
Are there opportunities that how do you spread this fever for bird watching beyond the haphazard chance that somebody sees one in the backyard? Are there efforts out there that kind of expand it?
Yeah, there are. And, you know, really, in our time, we started the magazine in 1978, and, you know, so that's 30-some years ago. In our time, we've watched this really wonderful development of all kinds of bird clubs, birding groups, birding festivals especially. So there are all kinds of festivals, 400-plus bird and or nature festivals across North America, including the, you know, there's a really great Kirtland's Warbler Festival right up there in central Michigan for the that really rare warbler that comes back up and nests in the pines there. And that's a great place for somebody who's interested in birds to go out to a local nature center or to a festival that's within their region, because really bird watchers are about the nicest people on the planet, and they always welcome newcomers. It's one of the things that we really pride ourselves on is that, you know, we are sort of a Pied Piper for people getting into bird watching, that they go and they have an interesting first experience, maybe encounter some their spark bird and some wonderful other birds and make a lot of new friends. And it's a great way to get into this wonderful hobby.
And it makes sense that, you know, you don't have too much envy not being able to get away, because a bird will always travel to you.
That's true. You know, birds have wings and they do tend to use them. That's for sure. Yeah.
Bill, I have a question for you. With the change of the weather and it turning spring here in Michigan, I have to imagine that a lot of birds are going to be returning to the area that you haven't seen over the last few months during the winter. In addition to some of the birds you have seen, where their color goes away, and all of a sudden they tend to become much more colorful this time of year. Can you talk a little bit about what people should be looking for in Michigan in terms of birds that are all of a sudden going to be popping up or getting more colorful?
Yeah, for sure. Right now, for those folks who are listening who have been watching their bird feeders, it's been a really great winter for finches and northern sort of species that come down farther south into Michigan and farther south than that even, to take advantage of the bountiful food crops. So things like evening grosbeaks and pine grosbeaks and bohemian waxwings and things have been coming through people's yards eating at their feeders and at their fruiting trees and things like that. A lot of those birds will be going back north now to nest where they where their normal spring and summer range is. But we're not going to be bird-free here, because just behind them, coming north from the south, will be things like warblers and orioles and tanagers and hummingbirds. All these things are going to be arriving back in Michigan in the next couple of weeks. And spring migration really peaks in Michigan and in Ohio, where I'm from, just about the first 2.5-3 weeks of May. And that's the best time where we live to be a bird watcher, because you can go out every morning and the air is filled with song, the trees and the bushes and the habitat's all full of all kinds of wonderful color. So it's a great, great time to get out to catch that wave of spring migration.
And when it comes to attracting these birds to your backyard, one of the things that I've noticed is that based on what kind of seeds my wife puts out, or peanuts or different types of items for the birds, we will attract some more unique birds. Can you explain to people what they might be able to do in order to attract some of the cooler woodpeckers that are out there, or some of the more rare birds that tend to be a little bit more bashful, but that great food just attracts them in more than anything else?
Right. There's a whole guild of birds that will come into our bird feeders, things like chickadees and nuthatches and titmice, blue jays, a lot of the woodpeckers that you mentioned. They will come into our feeders. Hummingbirds will come into our nectar feeders. To broaden the birds that you attract, I always recommend to people, don't just try to bring everything into feeders, because you're not going to get birds like warblers and tanagers necessarily to come into your bird feeders. You're going to need to offer them habitat, and water is a really great way to attract a lot of these songbirds and things like thrushes and bluebirds that may not come to your bird feeder, but they'll certainly come into a good source of water and to some really nice habitat. So if you can do things to enhance your backyard habitat, you have a much better chance of attracting some of these other birds.
And is it a expensive hobby for, you know, let's say I'm 14 years old and I've had my first spark, and what does it cost to get into something like being a bird watcher?
Well, you know, the two things you really need to be a bird watcher are, you need a something to magnify your view of birds. So usually we recommend people get a beginning set of binoculars.
Okay.
And nowadays, you know, with manufacturing costs being very low on some of these, you know, high-end things, you can really get a decent starter pair of binoculars for about $100 or less.
Okay.
And those will get you going just to start out. And you'll, sure, you know, if you decide to stick with the hobby later on, you'll you'll want to
trade up
a little bit more money and get something. Yeah, trade
sure.
up get something a little bit better.
Sure.
And then the other thing you need is a field guide to the birds,
okay.
something that shows you a visual picture that you can match with what you're seeing, and that helps you identify birds, which is kind of the core thing about bird watching, is seeing a bird and then putting a name on it. So the other thing I recommend for a brand new bird watcher of any age, young or old, is to get out with other people in the field. And you can do this at a birding event, at a nature center. I know there are lots and lots of state parks and nature centers throughout the state of Michigan. Almost all of them have a staff naturalist or volunteers who lead bird walks weekly, and virtually all of those facilities will be putting on spring bird walks, probably starting about now and running through the nesting season in I would say, mid-June. So that I would recommend brand new bird watchers get out there on one of those trips, ask a lot of questions, observe how the other bird watchers do things in the field, and that's a great way to get started.
Now, someone as accomplished as yourself, what's a great experience for you? What really excites you now that you've been bird watching for all these years? Are there trips that you can take? Are there certain birds that you shoot after, you know, that you go looking for?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of bird watchers maintain what's known as a life list, which is a list of all the birds that you've seen at least once in your life. And we have, in North America, we have 850 or so species that regularly occur or breed here in North America. So for a bird watcher, you know, to get to see 400, 500 or so of those species, that's really an accomplishment. It's a neat challenge when you go to a new area to think about, geez, what are the new birds I could see right now? So, you know, today, in the last couple of days, I've been down in South Florida with a couple colleagues, and we've been down here chasing after some of the rare birds down here. So it's a real thrill for me to add a new bird to my life list. That's quite a challenge, and it's almost like a, you know, it's almost like I would imagine what a hunter feels when they're pursuing their quarry, trying to, you know, and you finally nail it, and hey, you feel really excited about it. The only difference is we're using binoculars instead of guns, so the bird survives. But yeah, that's what's exciting for me. And, of course, I love traveling around the world to see birds in far-off exotic places, too.
Well, what bird is right in your mind right now that you're hoping that you'll be seeing either today or the next couple days? Is there one particular character?
Yeah, well, I'm riding in a car right now with my friend Jeff Bouton, who works for Leica, one of the best optics companies in North America here. And we're going to try to see a bird called the Lasagras flycatcher, which is a Caribbean and northern a sort of Central American species that is rarely found here in Florida. And there's one out on Key Biscayne that's been here a couple of winters in a row. And it's been seen this week, and we tried for it the other day. We didn't see it. So now we're heading over to Key Biscayne to try to see it again. And it's, unfortunately, we're stuck in traffic. So we're hoping once the heat of the day comes up here in Florida, the birds quit singing. They kind of go and take a siesta. So that's what happened the other day. We didn't get there until mid-afternoon, and everything was quiet. We missed the bird. So we're trying again today, and then we're going to go around and try and see a few other birds here. You know, South Florida has a lot of really weird parrots and things like that have escaped, which are really fun to see. And then I'm flying back to freezing cold Ohio this afternoon.
Well, it's not too bad there, Bill. But let me ask you this question, because one of the things that I'm curious about is for a lot of bird eggs, everyone always assumes that there are nests up in trees, but that's not always the case. There are a lot of nests that are built at ground level. What should people do if they come across these eggs, or if by chance they come across baby birds? What is the proper etiquette and procedure?
Now, that's a good question. We get lots and lots of calls every spring at Birdwatchers Digest. I found a baby bird. What do I do? You know, and the best thing is really to let nature take its course. Many, many times, the birds that people are finding are things like baby robins or baby cardinals or even a bird called a killdeer, which is a shorebird that nests in, you know, sort of in gravelly open ground. And these are birds that are it's part of their natural history, life cycle, that they are on the ground early in life. So a baby robin fledges out of the nest, and it makes its way around, hopping up through the bushes and on the ground, and it calls to its parents who come and feed it. So it's not in any danger. It can escape, get up in a tree if a cat comes or a snake. So there, you know, and robins are very prolific breeders, so we have plenty of robins. The worst thing you could do would be to scoop that baby up and put it in a shoebox and start feeding it bread. You know, that would pretty much guarantee its demise. If you leave the bird alone and watch from a distance to see if a parent is coming to care for it, many times you'll be pleasantly surprised to see that it is being cared for. It just happens to be on the ground or, you know, low to the ground. Now, if you see a nest, I always recommend to people just look at it from a distance. Don't touch it. We as humans, as we've expanded out into the habitat, you know, our suburbs and out into the woods and fields and things, we've trained a massive army of mammals and reptiles that the human scent trail that we all leave when we walk around means food. It either means dog dishes or yummy garbage or compost piles or something. And so, you know, things like raccoons and skunks and opossums and black snakes and, you know, foxes even, weasels, they all know that, hey, you know, that could mean food. So if you touch a nest or if you put a nest box up on a fence post without a baffle below it, you know, what you often are doing is kind of giving a hint to a predator that there could be a yummy meal right inside here or where this path leads you. I always recommend people to stay away from nests if they can.
Boy, that's excellent words of advice. When you look at it from that particular vantage point, you know, it changes your perception in a whole different way.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of these birds are very used to being around humans. They prefer to be around humans, but they also they can't defend themselves always against some of these predators. You know, a raccoon can rip the front off a bluebird box just as fast as you can say, happy spring. And before you know it, they're crunching down on the eggs or the babies. So, you know, we have lots of recommendations for keeping predators at bay, giving the birds a chance.
Well, Bill, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I just can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We've been speaking with Bill Thompson III, the editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest. Thanks again, Bill. We really appreciate you being here with us.
I appreciate it, Lee Rick. Thanks. Nice talking to you guys, and wish me luck on the flycatcher.
Yeah.
Good luck with it. And, Rick, we're going to continue the conversation about bird watching right after the break, right here on the Mid-Michigan Pet Expert Talk Show on 1320 WILS and 1320WILS.com.